This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and welcome to Night School, the show that walks you through fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, this show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and frameworks, the better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text or an idea we hope to shed light on the world around you. This week, we're going to talk about the Oedipus Complex, Sharat.
Ah, you know, it feels like we've talked about this before, but you're saying, but no, we haven't, have we?
We've done Freud a couple of times, and we've touched on it in considerable detail. Well, I mean, one discussion where it did come up was Freud's theory of psychosexual development. So how pleasure or sexuality blends in with certain characteristics that develop as an infant grows. So the Oedipus complex is part of that process. But today I figured let's take a look at that in greater detail and see what else Freud says about it.
So it's specific to Freud, this theory of the Oedipus complex. Now, you say Oedipus, I say Oedipus, or is
That's
it Oedipus
fine.
Both?
Yeah,
I guess Oedipus, Oedipus. Now, for starters, it comes from a Greek myth. And, right. You know, this is kind of a slightly literal question, was Freud building on what was known about the myth, or was he, in fact, using the myth as something that could, you know, as it were, give shape to a theory that he had developed from the kind of material he was encountering in his clinical work?
It sounds more like the latter, in that he felt that the Oedipus story, that the Greek myth, resonates at a universal human level, that it reflects a dynamic within families, and this is going to have social implications that has all-encompassing significance. The Oedipus story, which is Oedipus the King, basically, was a Greek tragedy by Sophocles. Touches on some... the plot is very strange, if you think about it, but some of the lessons that one can draw from it I find interesting. And that's what Freud does with the story as well. So he's going to acknowledge the plot and see that this plot is trying to tell us something about ourselves.
I mean, okay, there's several things that come to mind immediately. There are other types of complexes, things that seem perhaps similar, or like the Electra complex, mm-hmm. that also were developed by Freud. But
Electra complex was coined by Jung.
Oh, his, Jung.
Yeah,
okay.
So a one-time friend and then eventual rival.
Okay, so with the Oedipus complex, you know, it's centered on a male character.
Correct.
And, you know, is there a kind of gender dimension to this? Is something, because you say it's universal, but then it really puts at the center the story of a boy and a man in relation to his parents.
Correct.
Does that change for girls?
that's one of the criticisms, in that, as we'll discuss more, the central protagonist of this framework or theory of this complex is male. And when we get into details, rather racy details, we'll see that it's very specifically male, referring to certain organs that only males have. And this has invited criticism from feminists. And in fact, you know, to be frank, the Oedipus complex has in many ways has met with generations of refutations by now, but it's still nonetheless resilient. A lot of people feel that while it cannot serve as an empirical resource to understand who we are and why we behave in certain ways, it's nonetheless useful as a story, as a metaphor, as a way into some of the themes that presumably we all go through and trying to be, and when becoming human. Yeah.
Was Freud aware of the possibilities that there was a sort of gender bias in his story or his theory?
He was. But he was an MD, as most psychoanalysts have been. They're typically clinical practitioners. They see themselves as doing what doctors should be doing. So Freud always regarded his work as scientific. So he was, to him, it was just being descriptive. And if it didn't favor a feminist agenda, he felt that that wasn't really a criticism against him, because he thought he was just stating what he believes is scientific. So therein lies a problem, and I'm going to read some passages where he makes comments about that criticism. And he was very conscious of the criticisms against his project, the psychoanalysis project. I mean, even the idea of an unconscious, which is central to psychoanalysis, requires a lot of arguing and outlining to elucidate. It's not a given. So, I mean, even that, the most basic starting point is contentious. So what more the Oedipus complex, which we'll discuss more, I think, yeah.
Do we need to have a sense of what the unconscious is? If it's a real
yes.
thing, is it in the head, in the mind? Where is it?
In a sense, the Oedipus complex tells us how the unconscious is shaped. And I guess I might as well just start with it. And the rough outline of the Oedipus complex is that men harbor unconscious desires of making love with their mothers and killing their fathers, right? And this is outrageous, right? Imagine Freud in his bourgeois Viennese context coming up with this. And of course, everybody's just going to be really, really upset and offended.
You know, in fact, I think maybe the order would have been reversed. You'd have to kill your father first to substitute him and therefore be able to
correct.
Have access to your mother. I mean, that would be,
in the practical sense,
yes. the chronology of things. But yes,
correct.
Okay.
But for Freud, there's a reason for this. And because Freud believes that we begin as infants with this overflowing plenitude of pleasure and raw feelings. And this one can observe quite obviously in that kids, babies, they don't think. There's no gap between what is and what should be. And they'll do whatever they want. They'll put stuff in their mouths if they feel like it. They will poop wherever and when they see fit. And they don't have to explain themselves. And the world is such that for a considerable period of time, they are given as much freedom and license to just bounce off everything and make mistakes and whatever. And for Freud, this indicates a certain reality that we all share before we are to become adults, in that we are carried away by our feelings, and for the most part, our sole motivation is to feel good. And
to express ourselves. In fact, you know, there are many adults that you encounter in real life who you feel might have had a kind of childhood where they weren't given limits. They weren't told to stop or to think or to consider other people's feelings or to think before they speak. You know, there's people with no filters. You know, if you met
correct.
Them in public,
correct.
Then you think, oh my God, what kind of childhood? They must have had one of those really liberal upbringings where they weren't smacked enough, you know?
Yes.
But okay.
Yes, and there was no sense of shame, which is crucial to this Oedipal story, in that kids are not told or disciplined immediately to know what shame is about. So kids are just being what they're being, and there's again this plenitude, this overflowing desire that is as much as possible unbridled. And this is, you're talking about the first and second years of existing, and of course in this period, their partners in crime, you know, like a better word. That's me being flippant, but the other presence in this process is the mother. And the mother provides a sense of safe haven. The mother provides a sense of security, a sense of how would you say, fullness, that the child learns to identify with, right? So there is this, how would you say, union in a lot of ways. And this union is something that situates and locates the child in a position of happiness, you know, happiness in those terms, of course. And of course, this is not to last forever, right? Because there is also in this process, in the kind of nuclear process which Freud was most interested in, the father.
I want to just sure. to note at this point, I guess, that the mother, as we're talking about it, might seem to most people to be that fully formed creature with an identity of their own. But for the child, a mother is a kind of evolving being, isn't it? Because first the child is in their mother. I mean, really, the child is the womb. Mother is the womb. And then after the separation, mother must be essentially breast.
Yes.
Nipple and breast.
Yes.
And, you know, as the child comes to actually see more and more of the world, they might actually begin to recognize the fullness of the mother, not just in the physical sense, you know, all the limbs and such, but also in a social sense, because mothers are now recognized to be part of a social world. But for a long time, and perhaps for a very formative part of the infant's upbringing, they have a very curious relationship to mother. Mother might just be an object, that pleasure-giving, food-giving object, right?
Correct. And the child begins with an object fixation, which is the breast. But as the child develops, as the child becomes more cognizant of his whole body, right, from having merely oral pleasure and then to a focus on anal attention where he defecates suddenly becomes an issue for everybody. And then to the development of his phallus, the mother too acquires a fuller image for the child. And as the child realizes that the phallus projects, the phallus imposes, the phallus intrudes, a new trajectory enters in this relationship with the mother.
So now you already have a very gendered notion of the child, and we're already speaking of the male specific child, because clearly the female child has a very different body with all kinds of other kinds of symbolic resources, with very different notions of its relationship to the world.
Correct.
Right. So I mean, at this point we're putting aside the gender question
for now. For now, because the driver of this narrative is still the male baby. And at this point, the significance of the phallus becomes clear in this scenario. Perhaps not for the child yet, because there's no distinction yet. It's the child is still in this this abundant state of unthought, just going with instincts and going with raw feelings. But this is where the father problematizes the picture, because the father is at this point seen as a rival for the mother's attention, and the child can no longer indulge in that plentiful state of pleasure and carelessness. And at this point, as you rightly pointed out, it becomes a social process. A third person is in this dynamic, and with that, what we get is slowly the entrance of norms, the entrance of the regulation of sexuality, the entrance of gaps and roles in the family for the child to fit in. And this is where the Oedipus complex begins. Because when the father enters that that free-flowing, direct channeling of pleasure and raw energy, is upset, prohibition is introduced into the child's character, thereby strengthening the rigidity that's to eventually shape the family. Mother, father, child hierarchy is introduced and structured.
You make it sound like a bad thing, but isn't it all about society? That this is when society is made possible. Because before that, what you have is a non-society, right? And I can see all these asocial adults. I mean, one reads in the papers every day people who should have had a lot of spanking as a child, and you can just see they've grown up to be, you know, abusive politicians and policemen, whatever. So, okay.
Okay, yes. But this is going to be a gateway for the kind of discussion that Freud wants to have, which is how our earliest formation of identity is tied to those things. Like you said, the creation of a broader world in which we're going to play our roles. So, but for now, let's pause. And we're going to come back for the second part of the show, And you're listening to Sharat Kutan, myself Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and this is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is Night School, and you're listening to me, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. Alongside me, as always, is Sharat Kutan, and we were just in the middle of discussing the Oedipus Complex. It's really strange and racy, and in a lot of ways, you know, offensive to common sense, because this theory fundamentally posits that we all have an unconscious desire to kill our fathers and marry our mothers, right? This is not me making it up. It's not Sharat making it up. This is the famous theory of legendary psychoanalyst Sigmund Freud. And we were just discussing the point at which the Oedipus complex was formed. And that is when the child's careless, unbridled pursuit and embrace of freedom and pleasure becomes interrupted by the father, who then separates the child from the mother, who was for the longest time the conduit or the cushion for the child's sense of identity in the world, right?
Now, you know, when a regular family, you might imagine that the child, any child, might have multiple sources of rivalries for the mother's love, which is exactly what's at stake in the story that you're outlining, right? So it could be other children. You know, it could be children now growing, the eldest child who's the only child who now has to encounter a sibling and who, you know, who's in their mother's womb, and the mother has to kind of placate the child, saying, well, you know, I still love you very much, but you're no longer the center of my universe, you know. And the idea, I guess, that we all observe around us is that there are always rivals for our affection, you know, whether it's our mothers or lovers or whatever it is, that, you know, individuals that we seek pleasure from often are not completely or wholly devoted to us.
Yes, yes. And that's part of the ambivalence that Freud believes every child is going to encounter. In this Oedipus story, we've repressed our desire for the mother, which symbolizes that plenitude, that overflowing life that we once embodied as kids. This is going to set us in a very confusing course throughout life, because our conscious level bears a different notion or space of identity than the unconscious. And like you say, in the rivalry, when there's a lot of confusion and insecurity over attention with the mother, what is essentially happening is that this rupturing between the unconscious desires and the conscious desires wrestling together. And what's interesting as well, what Freud wants to point to, is what the role that the father, or the symbol that the father has in this whole process. Because the son, again, we come back to the son, we'll talk about the daughter soon, feels threatened. But the son projects all this hostility to the father as a defense mechanism, and the father therefore is seen as an authority figure with power, and thereby the superego is created, which is this internalized conscience that prohibits and rewards. So it's like this judge that we all have inside us to tell us what's right and wrong, particularly in relation to the pleasures we seek. So all this is happening, and that explains why we're ambivalent, and that explains a lot of times this ambivalence cannot be dealt with because it's been deeply repressed.
Now, if I remember correctly, in the story itself, in the Greek tragedy, Oedipus does not know that he's killing his father.
Correct.
And he does not know he's sleeping with his mother,
correct,
right?
Correct.
So he, if I can remember correctly, is abandoned. And then when he encounters this man on his way to a city, he actually kills him. And
unknowingly, who is the father. Yeah.
So how does Freud get from this story, which does not fit into a kind of voluntaristic, conscious desire to kill, you know, to one and then to sleep with the mother? How does he work it out? How does he then take that and make it useful for himself in trying to figure out this dynamic?
Basically, Oedipus the King is a story of the king named Oedipus, who is trying to figure out why his city of Thebes was suffering a plague. And as he was going through this, an oracle told him that it's because the land is polluted, and polluted in a ritual religious sense. that there was something had happened that contravened all moral sensibility, and therefore his city is suffering. And the play is such that it's basically a recollection. Oedipus, around people who are central to his life, there's a prophet, there's Jocasta, his wife, and turned out to be his mother eventually, and his brother Creon. And it's as he's figuring out, and this is a king, mind you, as he's figuring out why all this has happened, it turns out that the city was cursed because the king had killed his father and married his mother. And you can imagine that a king who had who became king because he saved the city from a monster, as a myth goes, suddenly realized that ultimately, despite his strength, despite his full confidence of who he was, is nonetheless subject to fate. And that's a microcosm of the lesson that Freud wants to show us here, that contrary to how we imagine ourselves as independent individuals, we are nonetheless connected to forces and desires that shaped us, that came way before us, that we had no say over. So there is this interplay between freedom and power, which is what being human is, being an independent individual is about, acquiring some sense of freedom and power. But at the same time, the binds of fate, the fact that we did come out and come into a nuclear family, that we did enjoy a certain freedom in childhood that we can no longer regain, but nonetheless impacted us. So this is this struggle that we play out inside us that connects the mysterious unconscious with our conscious narratives.
Freud isn't a psychoanalyst. He's trying to tell us something about our internal motivations, mm-hmm. and maybe some things that, Oedipus, we are unconscious of. We don't know. We're actually playing out scripts.
Correct.
That are sort of hardwired in us. Is that the claim? Is it as strong as that?
Correct. In the sense that no matter how we go about it, we are still anchored to the freedom. I wouldn't say the freedom, but the pleasures that shaped us as infants, because that was the immediate world through which we became who we were.
I mean, does so, anybody turn to Freud and say, "How do you prove this?" I mean,
that's a common rejoinder to say that there is no real empirical proof. And that's opened up this theory to a whole bunch of attacks. And there's also a critique of his conception of the father in all this. And the father is seen as largely a disciplinarian, as a figure to fear, more than what real-life fathers are like, which are always more complicated. To which Freudians say that, yes, of course, fathers can be dynamic in all sorts of ways, but fundamentally, the power to punish, the power to do things to us, to make us into certain types of individuals that fit into the norms of society is there. So it doesn't have to be disciplinarian in the sense of pain, infliction, but definitely, you know, insofar as the father plays football with the child, already, you know, there's a gendered process going on that is meant to situate us in a certain narrative of expectations, what it means to be a man, right? Or when the father watches an action movie with the son and tells him what's going on in the film. I mean, all these things are vessels for norms to be imposed on children.
I mean, and also that, you know, mothers tell their boy children how to be men.
Yes.
And schools tell you their boy pupils how to be men, and mm-hmm. the state does through the schools, yes. through policemen, through a whole range of institutions. I mean, you can imagine when if you don't take the whole issue in a literal sense, you actually see the dispersal of the figure of the father or the mother throughout society, and you know, appearing in different ways. Right.
Correct. So its dynamism lies in the fact that it's not meant to be an empirical confirmation of the things we talked about. It's more about what rooms for interpretation are we afforded given these premises. And this is where I find it very insightful, in that we see that the phenomena that we take to be in us, these prohibitions of desire and pleasure, plays out in society. So you really have a seamless conversation, really, that takes place out there, so to speak, and in here. So we don't see that our struggles are necessarily isolated as individual dilemmas, but are nonetheless connected to broader social forces. I mean, and this is why Freudians believe that the feminist critique of the Oedipus complex falls short, because insofar as it can explain why patriarchy reigns, why the phallus continues to be a signifier for control, for interjection, and in a lot of ways problematic repression, insofar as it can tell that story, then you have a very rich resource to better understand why it is that society is dominated by men. Because the potential of the phallus was curtailed. It must find outlets. It must play itself in society. And of course, we know it takes on many hideous forms.
Well, earlier you qualified repression. That seemed very interesting, because it seems in the kind of Freudian worldview, repression in some ways, you would take out the value component of it and how we use it on a daily basis. It's actually an important thing. It's like you need to somehow repress certain impulses in order to become fully functioning social being, right? Mm-hmm. And there is, and I think the later day Freudians or people like Herbert Marcuse, kind of developed the idea that there was a kind of necessary repression, which is about forming us as social beings, but there's also the repression that's maybe historically specific. So Herbert Marcuse, the Marxist kind of new left, right, would say that capitalism imposes a kind of repression that really is different from that which, is embedded in the formation of our personalities, for instance.
Correct.
There's a very interesting discussion around the meaning of repression,
correct,
isn't there, in that kind of discourse of psychoanalysis?
Fundamentally, there is this fear of freedom. There is this fear of anarchy that strikes the heart of all cultures. And that's why there are laws, and that's why there's prohibition against sexuality or regulations against sexuality or meaning imposed on who we can have sex with and why. And it's ambivalent too, right? This sense of anarchic desire for pleasure, because on one hand there's something very primal and human about it, but at the same time we know it's dangerous. So society is always struggling with that. How do we become animal, as naturalists tend to accept, and Freud was a naturalist, that there is this element, there is this moment in which we are not human because we are not ashamed, because we are not prohibited, but that is nonetheless us. So how do we become that while at the same time become civilized, with rules, with laws, with mores? And capitalism is one, and for Marcuse, capitalism is one stage in the story of human development whereby the mechanisms of repression become more sophisticated. So yes, in that sense, it's fascinating because insofar as capitalism shapes us, it will contribute significantly to our repression. But that's what ultimately gets that machine going, because when we repress ourselves, we have to go to work, we have to discipline ourselves as such to become law-abiding citizens, then things can happen, right? But if it's just...
You can build civilization.
You can build civilization. So that's the paradox in this story that I find quite rich, because it's not, the surrealist sort of French take on things, honed to that early stage of becoming, that is all about that plenitude of pleasure and raw feelings, right? We lose when we become human. And one need not do that. We need not glorify the infant state so much. But to just show that fundamentally what's happening is this deep ambivalence we have between the fact that here we are, largely repressed and having to be embedded in a system that leaves us powerless. But, we do recall, we do hug back. There is this pull towards the possibility of of really being loyal to our pleasures, you know. So this is just this back and forth.
Is there a therapeutic moment in this theory? Is Freud at any point saying, "Well, I'll help cure you of the Oedipus complex. Let's find a way of getting you to love your daddy and move on from mommy and find a nice girl from around the corner. Don't stop fixating in your mom." I mean, is there a therapeutic moment?
There is, and that's the entire Freudian project, is to really be okay with your ambivalence, come to terms with it, and accept some of our pathologies.
Because a pathology is a disease, right?
Shameless way, but to be able to function. He's getting back to the kind of scientific, practical guy he claims to be. Right, so you know your ambivalences. How do you function? Everybody's going to have it differently, but fundamentally, he's not a radical. There are subsequent radical Freudians who are going to do, orgy communes and stuff like that. But for him, it's really
Was this the 60s?
It was the 60s. Yeah, but yeah. For Freud, it's really just about that, coming to terms with really our ambivalences and overcoming shame. It's really a modest proposal in that sense. But I do want to touch on the whole gender the gender aspect, and that's the whole idea of the penis envy. The idea that for females who realize that their sexual organs are much smaller and cannot thus perform the thrusting and the kind of active penetration that the phallus can do, will feel at a certain loss to function, because the phallus seems to gain a lot of power in society, and because women do not have that, there is always a deeper lack than the man. So there's always, and Freud is quite clear that women trail in a deeper level of ambivalence and neuroses than men because they do not have the phallus. But of course, this has been largely ridiculed and critiqued by feminists as a mark of Freud sexism.
Who would you read if you're a feminist and you were kind of skeptical at this, or feeling that you got the short end of the stick on this theory because you're a woman, or you feel sympathetic to women, or you empathize with their position, who would you read?
There's one really good book by Rosalind Minsky called Psychoanalysis and Gender, an Introductory Reader. That's very good, and she gives an overview of the issue of gender from Freud, and then she touches on Winnicott and Klein, and then Lacan, even Kristeva. So how do they deal with this issue of gender as a controversy? But that's a really, really good anthology.
Well, yes, go on and buy a book.
Yeah, why not?
Even with
why
the
not?
GST on it.
No,
GST for books.
Yes,
so great.
Yes. So you can order that. I think it's really good. As an overview, Minsky is one of the, sort of, to me, the best summarizer or reviewer of psychoanalysis. She just writes so clearly and lucidly, and it makes it all accessible.
And is that true of Freud himself? I mean, is Freud something... someone you would pick up and recommend it, somebody read it if they're interested to hear it from the man himself, how he described the theory? Is it all in one book, or is it dispersed?
It's dispersed, but Ego and Id is good, and that's easily downloadable, and Freud writes very clearly. So
One of my favorites is Civilization and Discontent.
Yeah,
also.
One of my favorites as well. Mm. Very easily read and digested. He really wanted his theory to be accessible. He didn't want it to be an obscurantist movement. He wanted it to gain the recognition of the medical discourse of his time.
It's also like with Civilization and Discontent, it's really about reading society at this level, at
Correct.
The kind of macro level. He's not dealing essentially with individuals and individual pathologies. He's really looking at a civilizational level. And so that might also appeal to you if you're not interested in the kind of clinical level.
Or the gender issue,
I mean, there's quite a bit to recommend him. I mean, I think he was trying to make us think of our own society, or at least Viennese society of that period, in a different way. So,
Mm-hmm. Well, that's all we have for today. You're always free to write to us, bfmnightschool@gmail.com, or look us up on Facebook, it's BFM Night School. Just type it on the search space. Sharat Kutan is Sharat's handle. You are what? How many followers this time? Like 1,600?
Not yet. Oh. And I was kind of reaching there. But I think what's important is that, you know, the discussions I have on Twitter are largely political. But I also welcome discussions about these things, especially books. I mean, we could share ideas about books that we've read. And I think that would be fun to do on Twitter as well. I find that too much of Twitter discourse is political, and I get bored of that myself and saturated by politics. So remember, at Sharat Kutan, we can talk about books.
Wonderful. Thank you for listening. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. That was Sharat Kutan just now. You've been listening to Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.